Welcome to episode 17 of The Infectious Myth. Thank you, the audience, for listening to this show, whether live on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, or as a podcast afterwards. In either case, send comments, criticisms, or suggestions for future guests or topics to david.crow, and that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. And if you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. We're still getting some good feedback. For example, Gary Krasner wrote about our May 25th show, which was an interview with Dr. Harold Hillman on how microscope fixation and other processes change what we see, or what we think we're seeing. Gary said particularly good observations after the 30-minute mark, and it must be very hard to come up with content every week or so. Well done. I hope a lot of people listen. Actually, it's not too difficult to come up with content. That's what I rely on my guests for, and so far they've been amazing. Their stories of innovative scientific and medical ideas and subsequent censorship pressure or even downright persecution fascinate me. They're smart, creative, and brave people. Some of them may be wrong in their scientific positions, but we're all adults, and I'm happy to get both sides on the air so that my audience can make an informed decision. Today's guest is Dr. David Healy, another person I'm proud to be able to interview, a psychiatrist, a psychopharmacologist, scientist and author who has authored over 150 peer-reviewed articles, 200 other articles, and 20 books, including The Creation of Psychopharmacology, Let Them Eat Prozac, and most recently, in 2012, the book that is the title of this week's show, Pharmageddon. Dr. Healy came to my attention with his criticisms of the suicide risk of SSRI antidepressants even before I read his book, Let Them Eat Prozac. He's written and lectured on this subject, but has also testified in a number of homicide and suicide trials that involved antidepressants or other psychoactive drugs as a possible trigger for the violence. This is a brave step for an insider, and I remember when this cost him a position at the University of Toronto. He was fired before he started, but then reinstated because of the public outcry. If I remember correctly, Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, had given a lot of money to the institution into which he was being hired. Anyway, welcome to the show, Dr. Healy. I'm very pleased to have you with me today.
It's good to be here, David.
Yes. Well, I just read your new book, Pharmageddon, and it sort of extends what you wrote in Let Them Eat Prozac to a bigger view of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, you definitely see a lot of problems with that industry in that it's not focused on producing life-saving drugs as much as producing profits. Is that a pretty good overall summary?
Well, it is and isn't. It is in the sense that, yes, the industry aren't actually doing the job that we need them to do, which is really to find the drugs that we need. And they're producing more and more drugs we don't really need and persuading us that we need them when we don't. And none of this is good, but whether the focus should be on the industry or not is a bit less clear to me. If you ask me who's failing you, well, I think from the point of view of if you've got shares in any industry, you want to the pharmaceutical industry do the kind of thing they're doing. You want them to make money. If you've got your pension in shares of the pharmaceutical companies, then they're doing quite well actually for you. So there's, pros and cons. The industry are doing what they ought to do. To kind of suggest that in a way that the industry are failing is probably wrong. The people who I think are failing are probably doctors.
Mm.
They're the ones who haven't been stepping up to the plate the way they ought to do. These drugs are available on prescription only. And the understanding that doctors would go out there and battle for us. They were the kind of people who would find out the kind of materials or the details on different drugs that the industry have so that when you or I come to take them, that they'd be able to really know what the risks are and the hazards are and what the good points could be, and will be able to inform us properly. But doctors generally have been falling down on the job, I think.
It's
a slightly different spin on.
Right. Well, actually, one of the things that you said in your book that really surprised me, given that you're an MD, among other things, is that you, I don't know if you were actually seriously saying we should get rid of the whole idea of prescriptions, but you at least floated it as a thought experiment. I mean, I always thought, well, there's a lot of problems with the drug industry, and there's a lot of problems with pharmaceutical drugs, but at least prescriptions put some kind of a barrier between people's ignorance and taking a drug that might hurt them. But you seem to think that the prescription process is not really helping in protecting people from drugs that are harmful.
Okay, well, there's two or three things here. First of all, in 1962 was when we put the current arrangements that we have in place to try and keep us safe. Back in 62, there was the crisis about thalidomide, which was a sleeping pill, which caused women who took it during pregnancy to have children who were born deformed. And we were keen to try and make sure that that didn't happen again. And one of the things that seemed a good idea at the time was to make new drugs available on prescription only. One of the other things that seemed good at the time was to force industry to put their drugs through controlled trials, prove that they worked and that they were actually safe before they were left on the market. And you can make a good case that both of these things that we've put in place to keep us safe, which looked like a good thing then, have failed us, and that we need to not necessarily get rid of either of them, but we need to rethink them to a degree. As regards drugs being available on prescription only, one of the things is this. Most of the SSRIs, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, and drugs like this, began from antihistamines. They all were ultimately antihistamines, okay? And there's a few of the antihistamines we have, about half of them that are serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs also. Now, the serotonin reuptake inhibiting antihistamines can make you more anxious and agitated, can make you feel bad, can make you feel odd. And, you know, there probably is a few people that go on these drugs who become suicidal even.
Right.
But we don't hear about people going out and killing themselves on them. We don't hear about people becoming homicidal and killing others on them. Because if you get a drug that's over-the-counter, one of the things is that if it isn't one that suits you, you sort of don't take it anymore. The problem is if you go to a doctor like me, and particularly if I'm nice and understanding and things like this, you come to me and you're feeling bad, and I put you on this pill, and you feel worse. And you don't necessarily know that it's the pill. You come back and you say to me that I'm feeling worse, and I say to you, well, you have to keep on having these pills, and they couldn't be causing the problem. And you don't want to make me unhappy, because the worse you feel, the more I'm the way out for you. You know, you're hoping that in due course things get really bad, that I'm going to be the one that's going to help you get out of this prison that you're now in.
Right.
So you want to keep me happy, and you don't want to say to me that anything that I might have done in good faith, I mean, really hoping that I was going to help you, had actually made things worse. So you don't mention it. And the thing is, if the pill is causing you to feel worse, and particularly if I sort of increase your dose, then that's a real recipe for things going wrong, in a way that they wouldn't go wrong if the drugs were available over-the-counter. Now,
so
a few things we can do. I mean, if the drugs are available over-the-counter, I stand to be out of a job to a degree, so I'm not really saying that this is what I want. There's a few things we could do. One is, there's not a medical course on earth that teaches trainee doctors about marketing. And the thing is, if drugs are available on prescription only, most people listening in here think that they're the consumer of the pills, and they think it even more because they see direct-to-consumer adverts.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, industry regard me and doctors like me as the consumers, and they spend $50,000 per annum on each of us, understanding us better than we understand ourselves, and really getting us to the kind of position where we have almost become drug pushers. Before 62, we were the people who were skeptical about drugs, who would say to the people in the street who were over-enthusiastic about drugs, look, you don't want to believe all this hype about these things you hear. You know, you want to sort of take all this with a
grain of salt.
But that's not what we get now. You find a lot of people go into their doctors now skeptical about drugs and not terribly keen to go on more drugs and find that they're having more drugs pushed on them.
Right. So if I just want to repeat this. You said that drug companies for each doctor pay about $50,000 a year. on marketing costs per doctor. And a lot of that is, it sounds like it's to try to get the goodwill of the doctor, so that
it's not handing over money, and it's not necessarily bringing it out to meals and that. They're very, very good at that. The drug company reps that come to see me, for instance, will know my wife's name and my children's names and their birthdays. They'll be friends, okay?
Right.
In actual fact, they're doing much more than that. They're not trying to sell the pill to me or so much as trying to understand me and work out what kind of pitch will work for me.
Right.
But among the key pitches isn't the sort of pens, and they're happy if I turn down the pens and the free lunches and this, that, and the other. And particularly if I say, well, look, you know, the things that actually persuade me is the evidence.
Right.
Industry put a lot of effort into creating the evidence. And as things stand at the moment, most of what appears to be the evidence which supports the prescriptions that most doctors write is literally manufactured by industry. They ghostwrite almost all the articles on drugs that are on patent, even the ones that are in the most prestigious journals, like the New England Journal of Medicine, will be ghostwritten. They're not written by the people who appear to be the authors, and in all cases, no one has access to the data from the clinical trials that the articles purport to report on. So it's a world which is just it's a world that's gone crazy.
Well, you started off saying doctors are a problem, but you know what you describe in your book about what the drug companies do. I mean, ghostwriting is basically they write the article and then they basically give it to a doctor with some prestige and say, how would you like to be the lead author or co-author on this, so that they get the prestige of the doctor is kind of hiding the fact that the drug companies have written it.
Yeah.
But you also described how...
Who do you blame there? Do you blame... I mean, so this would, I mean, this is a key thing for people listening in. Do they blame the companies for trying to do that, or do they blame, or should we blame the doctors who are happy for their names to appear as the authors on the article, even though they haven't had access to the data behind the article even?
Well, I would say both. I mean, if you go to the mayor's office and with money and say, you know, I'd sure like to develop this empty lot into a skyscraper, then you're both guilty if the money changes hands.
Yeah.
Of something. And the other problem is if there's one drug company and thousands of doctors, even if one doctor is very moral and refuses any kind of offer like that, there's always another one they can go to, right? So but other things you describe that the drug companies do is, and it's not also not just the drug companies, but they do a lot of smaller studies. And the ones that are negative or not positive, that don't find a benefit for the new drug, tend not to get published.
Well, they do even more than that. In the case of all of the ones that actually do get published, the ones that are good and the ones that aren't good, they hide the data from all of them. And it turns out that the ones that are even more dangerous than the ones that don't get published are the ones that were negative studies that are ghostwritten up to be positive. It's only anyone who has access to the raw data is able to realize, actually, this Victor trial, where they say this was a positive study and the drug worked well and was safe, was a trial where the drug didn't work and wasn't safe.
Yeah, you described a lot of hiding behind p-values, which is sort of the statistical probability. And if they can do a big enough study to get a small benefit that goes above the 0.05 p-value, then they claim that it was successful. But on the other hand, they try to make the studies too small to get a statistically significant number of side effects, such as suicide in the case of antidepressants.
Yeah. Well, this is a key thing. And so if you ask me what the... just to try and boil down what the key issue at the moment is... If you come in to see me, if I'm trying to treat you for some problem, respiratory, gut, nervous, whatever. And I put you on some treatment and things go wrong. We're in a world where doctors have been steadily coached over the last 20 to 30 years to believe that the evidence that comes out from controlled trials is better than the evidence of our own eyes. And this is particularly the case now, I mean, sort of when you've got both a patient, I mean, these days an awful lot of the patients that come to see me have access to the internet and things like that, and they're highly motivated, and they know an awful lot more about the drugs that I'm going to put them on than even I do, okay?
So
the idea that I wouldn't work with them is crazy, but when you get good and motivated patients like this coming up with saying, look, I've been on this pill and this has happened to me, and I agree with them, I can see that it's happened, and I halt the drug and the thing clears up and maybe we put them on the drug again and it reappears, it's very, very convincing that the drug is actually causing the problem. But we get told that evidence-based medicine, that trials that have been done show no evidence for this at all, and therefore, you know, you can't believe the evidence of your own eyes. That's the bind with us at the moment. Control trials can be very helpful and can show how both patients and doctors can be biased by their hopes that the treatment is going to work, for instance. We're in a world where both doctors and patients have lost the ability to believe the evidence of their own eyes anymore. And controlled trials have also done, just in terms of the treatments people take, back in the 1950s, 1960s, the treatments we had, new treatments that came on stream, which saved lives, they were all regarded as poisons. And there was a real art to good medical care, which was to use a poison like this and out of the use of a poison to bring some good. I mean, this was a truly magical thing.
Right. But
what clinical trials do is transform, because they hide the adverse events, they get the doctor to focus simply on, is this drug working or not, and not ask the patient in the trial anything else about what the drug might be doing. Because they hide the adverse events, what they do is they transform these chemicals into fertilizers, which once they go through the clinical trial process, the impression we all end up with, doctors and patients and regulators and people in the government, all end up with the impression that these things work, and that really what we need to be doing is to ensure that people end up on as many fertilizers as we can get them on, that this can only do good, and end up on them from a pretty young age if we can manage it.
There's a lot more diagnosis of, especially in psychiatric area, there's a lot of diagnoses of very young children with diseases and like ADHD, ADD, whatever, but also things like bipolar, which have much more potent treatments.
Absolutely. No, there's been an extraordinary change in culture here, and this is the key thing that we need to try and undo. It's, I'm unsure what you think or what the audience will think about climate change generally. Are we really facing into climate change? Well, whatever about the wider world, within healthcare there has been a real climate change from a world where drugs were viewed with caution and you didn't put people on them too long and you certainly didn't put people on huge cocktails of drugs. And if you did put them on these things, you really kept an eye on what was happening, and you expected them to have adverse events, and you handled these things. Now it's a world where these drugs are clean. They don't have adverse events, in theory, and we've been happy to put people on drugs for years and years. Not just one drug, but cocktails of drugs. I mean, this is a real recipe for things going badly, badly wrong.
Well, especially older people, I've heard that many older people are on like 10 or 20 daily pills for a variety of things, some of which are probably side effects of some of the pills they took earlier.
Absolutely, yeah. There's an increasing number of people who end up on huge big cocktails, and there's a word for what actually happens here. So people end up in a prescribing cascade, that you go on one drug like an antihypertensive, and that leads on to pain, for instance, and you get on painkillers, which lead on to gout, and you get on treatments for gout, which lead on to further problems. And, you know, what you get the whole time is drugs being added into the mix without people going back to the start and realizing that actually all this person's sequence of problems begin with one issue when they went on the first pill they were put on, and if we'd only reduced the dose or put them on a different antihypertensive or tried a different treatment for raised blood pressure, we'd have been able to avoid all of the other problems that they later end up with.
Right. And, of course, solutions that include lifestyle change, like exercise, better diet, things like that, I mean, the patients themselves are at fault for saying, I want a quick, easy solution. I don't want to, you know, have to start walking every day. I don't want to have to stop eating fried food or, reduce the quantity of sugar I eat. So people, to some extent, are willing participants in this whole drug polypharmacy.
Well, let's not be too hard on people.
Okay.
Often we draw, we sort of have on one side, you know, the quick fix from the pill, and on the other side, the difficult fix. You know, you've got to exercise, look after your diet,
right,
get the weight down, cut out all these things that are nice. But after the fact, you know, there's a middle way, which is really just not do anything. I mean, you know, yes, if you get fit, this isn't really going to harm anyone. But if you're a little bit of a slob, not too much of a slob, like me, for instance, I mean, I don't do a huge amount of exercise.
Right.
Like that. But, you know, often just going easy on yourself isn't a bad recipe.
Right.
You know, it's what in an awful lot of these cases, what people are talking about is treating risk factors, not
right,
a true illness. And the thing about a risk factor is this, is you often have to treat anything between 10 and 100 people so the one person doesn't get the problem. Now, what that means is that most of us, even if we don't try and get fit and don't change our diet, if we don't take the pill, most of us, 99 of us, aren't going to get the problem anyway. You know.
Actually, my first question was going to be about blockbuster drugs. It took me a little while to get my head around the fact that a blockbuster drug has to be for chronic disease or for prevention of a chronic disease, like a cholesterol drug that's supposed to prevent heart disease later. And the reason why blockbusters are for chronic disease is because they have to be taken for the rest of your life, and therefore the sales are much higher.
Absolutely, yeah. And these are the drugs that interest industry the most. They don't like the idea of a drug course that you take for a week or two and then the problem's cleared
right
up. What they want is they want you on a drug which you're going to be on for years. And the ideal thing, I mean, the other thing from industry's point of view is it's very, very difficult to treat a heart attack. It's very, very difficult to treat a stroke. These are the kinds of things, though, that we do want industry to really try and treat. It's very, very easy to lower a cholesterol level, to lower a blood pressure, without actually doing any good. So it's like for industry, drugs which lower risk factors tend to be like rolling off a log. They're very, very easy to make, and they almost can't go wrong. You know, the drug will, in 9 cases out of 10, it's going to produce the outcomes that they want. Okay, so from the industry's point of view, this is win-win. And if they can get you on a few of these drugs for the rest of your life, well, you know, you do more for the health of the pharmaceutical company than the pharmaceutical company is doing for your health.
Right, and then if the pharmaceutical company wants a bit more revenue from a particular area, all they need to do is get some guidelines changed so that the point at which you start cholesterol drugs is lower. And then there's a massive increase in the number of people who have to be on these pills.
Yep. And you can encourage people, you can begin to write guidelines even for children to go on these drugs. And an increasing number of children are going on drugs to lower cholesterol levels, which is just crazy.
Well, you pointed out one of the things, I think I also saw it in Marcia Angel's book, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. I think this is a common phrase when I was reading your book. It seemed like a good idea at the time to say that there should be trials on drugs in children because you can't really use a drug that was tested on adults and children with any degree of safety. And the response was, well, we'll extend your patent life. But the consequence of that is that they're testing drugs in children that have really no applicability to children, such as cholesterol drugs.
Yeah.
Well, and then maybe they want to start using cholesterol drugs in children.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that happens when you do clinical trials like this, and if you show you can lower cholesterol levels in children, then it becomes a case of, well, if we can do it, shouldn't we do it? It becomes very hard to resist. You create the impression that the child or the person is vitamin deficient, and that there really is a moral onus to go in there and
right.
put right what's wrong. When, in actual fact, you know, you're really not putting right what's wrong. You're changing just natural variation. There's a group of us who've got higher cholesterol levels than others, but it's no harm. I mean, I've got a very high cholesterol level, but the last thing that I would take is any of these drugs which lower cholesterol, because they have too many problems linked to them.
Right.
There's a very, very small chance that I could do myself some good by taking one of these drugs. There's a tremendous chance that I will do myself harm in one way or the other, and make myself very neurotic also.
Right, right. Always worrying about blood pressure, cholesterol, or whatever other PSA levels. There's all kinds of things to worry about if you're an aging male, and if you're an aging female, it's a different set of things to worry about. One of the things you really criticized a lot, which, was probably surprising to some people, is the whole concept of randomized control trials and evidence-based medicine. And you've described how, in some cases, trials are kind of spun from negative into positive, but you also described how it was essentially outright fraud in the manipulation of suicide statistics. Like, you talked about a case where a suicide occurred prior to the trial really starting, but it was in the placebo arm, so that got added to the list of placebo was the only placebo suicide. And also some other manipulations of data to avoid publication of randomized clinical trials showing that there was an increased suicide risk. This seems a little bit beyond unethical into almost criminal behavior.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things that are actually, frankly, criminal that happen. A lot of the time we can't see them happening because, as I've repeatedly said, we don't have access to the data. It's only in a very few instances where people have been expert witnesses in medical legal cases and have been able to get access to the data that they've been able to see these things. But aside from all that, let's say the trials that were being done by angels rather than the pharmaceutical companies, and everything was totally above board, and we could get access to the data. There is a real problem with clinical trials. Well, there's two or three of them. One of which is that if in the course of a clinical trial you're trying to get the doctor and the patient to focus in on one or two key things, the drug does. But in actual fact, drugs do 99 things in most of us. And in fact, some of the things that the company isn't keen to hear about, they do more often than the things that the company wants to show the drug does. Okay?
Right.
So getting both the doctor and the patient to focus in on the things that the company wants us to focus on is a kind of hypnosis that blinds us to a lot of the other things that the drug's doing. At the end of the day, then, we write up the article which says the drug did this and this, and miss the fact that it's also doing a lot of other things. And these articles end up being the definitive word about what the drug does and doesn't do. And the problem is, you know, there's people like me maybe who've been involved in these trials and saying, we didn't see the drug do any of these awful things, when in fact it actually did. Okay, so the trial process itself can be a problem from that point of view. There's a further problem, which is lots of the things drugs do to you in terms of making you fatigued, giving you cognitive problems, or in the case of the antidepressants, this is a good instance, that both depression can make you suicidal and the drug can too. Now, if they can both cause the same thing, there's no way that a trial can easily let us know what the drug's doing. If you do these trials in healthy volunteers, if you give the drugs to healthy volunteers, that's a proper trial of the drug. It's a proper drug trial. When we're doing a trial of an antidepressant in people who are depressed, that's a condition trial. Call them drug trials, but they're not really trials of the drug. It's the illness that will often mask a lot of the problems that the drug causes. So from that point of view, there's a few different reasons why controlled trials really often don't give us the correct answers. They can be helpful, particularly when they show drugs don't work. But in actual fact, as you've hinted earlier, when the trials show the drug didn't work or didn't do all that well, the company's quite likely to bury it.
Right, and I was actually talking to Eric Turner recently, who I believe you mentioned in your book, and he said that the journals don't like to publish articles that don't have a positive story. They want something that affects clinical practice, which means you're proving that a new drug is better than an old. And also the researchers aren't as enthusiastic about pushing forward a study for publication when they feel that it was a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Which sort of illustrates their attitude, I guess, towards the successful trial.
These are the trials that should be the most important, the ones that show the drug didn't work. What they do is they do a very useful thing. They really put the onus back on say, the pharmaceutical company, or whoever is going to make money, or is hoping to make money out of sick and vulnerable people. It puts the onus back on them, saying, well, okay, if you think your drug is all that good for people who are depressed, or people who are in pain, or people who've got Parkinson's, or whatever, find the kind of people who are depressed, or the kind of pain condition, or the kind of Parkinson's cases where the drug is helpful, because it's sure as hell not helpful when we just give it blindly to everyone who's depressed, say.
Right. If we go back to the antidepressants, the bottom line was, we're going back to the 1990s here, but the bottom line was that the risk of suicide from Prozac, for example, was almost double, which was hidden through the manipulations of the randomized clinical trial process for a long time, right?
Yeah. That's correct.
And one of the things you said that was very interesting about antidepressants was that, you know, they're basically antihistamines, and the whole origin of the term SSRI, ACE inhibitor, statin, those are all more marketing terms than actual really scientific terms.
Yeah, absolutely. They're almost all invariably things that are coined within the marketing departments of companies.
Right, with the aim of if you can get people to buy in, and here we're talking about doctors and the general public, if you can get people to buy in that there is a chemical imbalance in your body, then the question, of course, is, well, what drug do I take to correct the chemical imbalance?
Very simple ideas like this have been terribly powerful in driving both doctors and patients who may be reluctant to use pills to use them. You know, it does feel like you're creating a state where people regard themselves as being in some way vitamin deficient, as it were. And there's a kind of moral onus to top your vitamins up to the right level.
Yes. I really have seen that in society over the past 20 years, where people do talk about chemical imbalances in the brain, about this person, you know, had a chemical imbalance and the drug helped. And of course, there is a powerful placebo effect, so that you don't really, you know, if somebody takes a drug and feels that their symptoms are better, they will assume that the drug's working, and they may ignore the fact that in some other ways they're feeling worse, the side effects of the drug. I was thinking about clinical trials. It seems like the standard phase 3 clinical trial is designed to show whether a drug works or not. But you mentioned, you know, healthy volunteers taking a drug, which is a phase 1 trial, I think.
Yeah.
Where you give a drug for safety, but those are so small that rarer side effects just will not show up. Is that?
Well, not quite. That's kind of the argument about the antidepressant trials. The idea was it's so rare that people become suicidal on these drugs that, you know, we'd have to have huge trials to be able to find it.
Right.
But in fact, part of the problem is, you see, that in fact people are becoming suicidal because of their illness and because of the drug. And what it's awfully hard to disentangle these. Back before the SSRIs came on the market, about 10 years before most of them came on the market,
right.
Pfizer did a healthy volunteer trial for Zoloft here in the UK, and they had 12 women actually involved in it. It was a placebo-controlled trial, and it was stopped after a week because the women taking Zoloft became agitated and in some cases became suicidal, and the company concluded that their drug had caused the problem. Okay.
And yet later, Zoloft was approved.
Yes. Okay. But the interesting thing here is these drug trials in healthy volunteers, because there's not the complicating aspect from the illness, there's an awful lot of problems that people think of as being rare, which actually aren't all that rare, which show up quite clearly in even quite small healthy volunteer trials.
Right.
And in this case, there's big arguments about, do the companies say, well, withholding the data from the clinical trials we've done because of patient confidentiality. But in this case, in the case of healthy volunteers, there are no confidentiality issues involved, so there's no reason why we couldn't have all of the data from these trials, but in fact, we've got none of it.
But, it says a lot that that a drug company would find that information, which should have been like an atomic bomb in terms of the future success of this drug, but they pushed ahead and ended up getting it approved anyway.
Yeah, because, again, the calculation to some extent will be, it's going to be very difficult for anyone to prove our drug causes these problems. And it is a curious world. You asked me, earlier about whether the industry are guilty or not. We do have a world where talking behind the scenes to people from industry, they will concede that they know their drug causes problems.
Right.
But in the public domain, they'll say just the opposite. They'll say, no, there's absolutely no evidence. And usually by this, I mean there's no controlled trial evidence. You do have to ask the question about what's actually going on here. How do industry people manage to speak speak with a forked tongue, I guess?
It's an interesting thing about institutions. It's like military institutions where people will sometimes end up doing really horrible things. But it sort of builds as part of an institution. Everybody's doing the same thing, so it becomes more and more acceptable to do things that from the outside seem terrible. And to an outsider, to the drug industry, who might naively believe that the only purpose of the drug companies is to produce life-saving medications, they might find this kind of thing shocking, and it should be shocking.
Yeah.
In your book, read a quote which was, you included a quote which was quite touching. It was a woman named Mary Ellen Winter who had lost her daughter to suicide from taking Paxil. And I'd just like to read a couple of lines from it. When we believed the FDA would always act to protect our family's well-being, when my daughter went to our family GP last year, we trusted that our doctor was well-educated and informed. We were wrong. We now know that pharmaceutical sales are a high-stake business driven to increase shareholder wealth. The consolidation of pharmaceutical companies like GlaxoSmithKline has resulted in increased sophistication in the quest to market and distribute pharmaceutical products. It was very touching and very eloquent, but what it said to me was how terrible it is that this woman became so eloquent only after she lost her daughter, and if she had been educated about how the system worked, she may never have allowed, or she may have discouraged her daughter from going on Paxil in the first place, or a similar antidepressant.
Yeah, well, I think it isn't just her, but I think the daughter would have been reasonably slow to go on it also.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what she does raise there is the issue of, we once upon a time trusted FDA to keep us safe. It looks like we can't trust them now. We've gone through some pretty gloomy stuff in the conversation.
Right.
Up to this. Let me introduce a slightly more optimistic note.
Okay.
One of the things that with colleagues I have been doing in the last few years is to create an adverse event website called risk.org.
Right.
Okay. And it's a place where people, well, first of all, FDA have adverse event data where doctors and patients and others have reported into them on a range of drugs that, you know, that cause this or that or the other. Now, what we do is on risk.org, we've downloaded the FDA data and we make it available to people for free. You can go in and put in almost any drug that you could be on, whether it's an osteoporosis drug or a gut drug or whatever, and look at the range of problems that have been reported into FDA on this drug. It gives people a feel for when, like, for instance, had a really good case, or a good instance just last week. I have a friend who's a doctor, and she'd had a minor fracture. She's an athlete, and the orthopedic people she went to see want to try and put the problem right quickly. So they gave her one of the latest osteoporosis drugs called Fortio.
Right.
And fairly soon after she got it, this is a drug you get by injection. She had a very severe back pain, and she went along to the doctor who'd put her on it and asked, could this drug cause that? And he said no, and she checked with the company who make Fortio, and they said no. In the end, she was pretty convinced. Every time she had the injection, she had the back pain. She was pretty convinced the medication was causing the problem. Now, this is a woman who knows healthcare because she herself is a doctor, but she felt the system was almost driving her mad. It just didn't put any weight on her strong hunch that this drug was causing the problem.
Right.
We checked out on risk.org. She just happened to be in the office. We were having tea, coffee. She happened to mention this. I went in and put the name of the drug she was on into risk. And what do you know, there's been close to 1,400 reports to FDA of people getting severe back pain on this drug, which was just the kind of problem that she had. So that's the kind of thing you can do. We're also trying to do one more thing, which is to get people to enter any adverse events that they're having on whatever drug they're on. And the idea is to try and generate a report.
Right.
For you or for whoever may be having any kind of problem. The idea is to take you through a bunch of questions, which are the kinds of questions an expert would take you through if they're trying to work out has the drug caused the problem or not.
Right.
At the end of the day, we give you a score. Now, the score, even if it's a high one, doesn't prove the drug has caused the problem.
Right.
What we do is we get you to the point where you can print out a report which describes the problem that you've actually described and gives you a score and lets you take it to the doctor who's put you on whichever drug it is. And the hope here is to try and even out the power relationships between the doctor and the patient. If you go along to a doctor and report a problem, it's hard to report these things. But let's say you're feeling brave, you're feeling strong, and you go in there and report that this seems to be happening to me on
right,
you
know, right, some kind of side effect. Yeah.
I mean, if it's not actually recorded, he can blow you off. You know, he can say, "Well, you know, I really don't think a drug you're on could be causing this," and
right.
You end up going out the door, and maybe things do go wrong. But he can blow you off because even if things do go wrong, it isn't actually recorded anywhere. If you go in armed with a piece of paper, a report
yeah.
which lets him know that it is recorded somewhere, and if you walk out the door and things do go wrong, well, he might not be in as comfortable a position as he
right.
was before. This makes him more likely to sort of engage with you. Now, we're not trying to get people to do this to be hostile to doctors. We're really trying to get the kind of engagement that
right.
is critical to good medical care. And actually, you know, what we're trying to do is wake doctors up. When people go on drugs, and particularly if they go on new drugs, new things are going to happen that aren't
yeah.
in the company label, that aren't in the mm-hmm. books. It's a chance for, you know, the doctor working with a motivated patient to really get a bit more fun back in the job. Yes, it's a bit grim if things are going wrong, but it's a chance for both the patient and doctor to find out new things and maybe answer things that will help others avoid having the same kind of
right.
problem.
Do a little bit of detective work into the drug, or maybe have a discussion about, well, you know, is a drug, you know, to fix a minor problem, are we going to end up creating a bigger problem, and should we rethink the whole business about going on a drug? You mentioned in your book, and I've seen this kind of statistic many times before, that the percentage of adverse events, nobody knows the exact percentage that are reported, but it's generally believed to be between 1 and 10%. So does your new website allow people to report these side effects? Is that what people are doing
Absolutely.
As well?
Yeah, the idea is to get people to report, and we can get you, we can fix it so that your report goes on to FDA, so it's not just reporting to us only, but it's about trying to get a report and get you to take it to the doctor, or maybe a pharmacist, and get them to add to the report. Because our hunch is that it's actually a doctor and a patient, or the patient and maybe the pharmacist or nurse, actually they are able to look at the problem and tweak the dose, or maybe halt the pill for a bit to see what happens, who are
right.
much better placed than a bureaucrat in FDA, who's often in FDA because, you know, well, they don't like meeting patients. And if they're in FDA and they've been there for years, maybe they're trained in mental health and you're taking a renal drug, you know, they know nothing about either the condition you've been treated for.
Right.
Or, you know, they haven't used this drug, particularly if it's a new drug and they've been in FDA for years and years and years. So our hunch is that you and your doctor are almost always going to be much better placed to work out if the drug actually causing the problem than the bureaucrat is.
Mm. And does the FDA accept reports from outside the United States?
It does. Indeed it does, yes. Now, what we do for people outside the United States is they've got an option to report to their national regulator also.
Okay.
But if they don't wish to do this, or if they haven't got a national regulator, they have an option to report to FDA. So
and
FDA does take reports from outside the States, and if you go into RISC and have a look at the reports they have on drugs, just the ones that have come straight to them, not going through RISC, you'll see that they often have sort of up to a third of the reports can come from outside the United States.
And does the FDA react to a high level of reports, or does it take some other pressure before they'll start to rethink the approval of a drug?
Yeah, now this is a good, I mean, this is one of the key things why it's helpful. I mean, if you are going to report to FDA, and we would encourage anyone that reports to RISC to also press the report this to FDA button.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to report to FDA don't do anything much. They take the time. They don't want to
right.
rock the boat. And they're very, very slow to agree that the drug has often caused the problem. Often you'll find inside the pharmaceutical company they've agreed that the drug is causing the problem long before you'll get FDA to actually agree the drug is causing the problem. But what we hope to do in RISC is to get doctors and patients engaged in the issue and encouraging them, if they really think it's kind of likely the drug has caused the problem, to make that statement. You know, so and that's one of the things. And the other thing is that it's often, I mean, what we will have is reports which we know have been made and have gone on to FDA also. So if FDA are being asked, do you have reports on this particular problem or not, we'll know if they're not being absolutely honest, if you see what I mean.
Right, because you've submitted them. I mean, I think given the history of the FDA, they have not been an activist organization in terms of looking closely at drugs. And I think one of the most shocking things you said, I think in the first book I read, Let Them Eat Prozac, was that a drug company doesn't need to prove that a drug does anything really amazing. All it really needs to prove is it does something, even if it's a trivial change in a surrogate marker that might not be directly related to health.
And
yet,
shock you good and proper then, okay?
What's
and,
that?
Probably cause anyone listening to the program to wonder if I've gone mad. In terms of the criteria, the hoops companies had to jump through to get an SSRI on the market, okay? The kinds of rating scales that were used to show that the drug worked are not, and the opportunities they had to do multiple trials and only let the world know about the one or two that were positive, and the opportunities that they had as well to sort of code the data behind the scenes so that things looked right. If you or I had the resources to put alcohol through a clinical trial of the kind that the SSRIs were put through, we could show that it was an antidepressant.
Right.
The SSRIs are literally no more antidepressant than alcohol is. They do a thing. They make you a bit numb. They chill you out a bit the way alcohol can do, but they're not. I mean, there's nothing more intrinsically antidepressant about them. And just if you think about it, you know, people will. I mean, if you're trying to sell alcohol as a true antidepressant to people, they'd think, you know, this is just crazy. This is just not right. This is just not proper. But there isn't any better evidence that the drugs that are being sold to us as true antidepressants truly are antidepressants.
Yeah, I guess there's two problems with promoting alcohol as an antidepressant. The first is that, you know, people in general have knowledge of alcohol and would say it's crazy. But secondly, you can't patent alcohol.
Yep.
And all of these SSRIs were patented and therefore had exclusive marketing and much higher prices.
Yep. And and that's the key to the whole thing. We've got to, we do, that's one more thing that we maybe need to look at if we're going to put things, or if we're going to try and make the whole drug discovery process work better. Clearly, the pharmaceutical companies do need to be rewarded for actually producing drugs that really are the kind of things that we need. So we need some kind of system that gives them the sort of due rewards for the work that gets done. But at the moment, they're over-rewarded for drugs that are really trivial. They really aren't of any great benefit to us, and in fact, maybe doing more harm than good. Now, any of these kind of systems are man-made. What it does need is some politicians or whoever to go in there and have a look and see what can be done. Are there any other ways to manipulate the system so that we get the kind of outcomes which are win-win, which is the pharmaceutical industry does get some rewards and that enables them to go on and develop more drugs. And on the other hand, in return to the rewards they get, we get drugs that we really need.
Right. I mean, some of the things that you described about patents were things like when a drug is about to reach its patent life and then will become basically a generic drug, you then patent the metabolite of the first drug. So it's really essentially you're patenting the same thing, but because it's chemically different, you can get away with it. I mean, it would seem that they could at least, at the very least, tighten up the patent system so that you're actually truly patenting something as innovative and not just one atom different or one step further down the metabolic chain from once you put it in your mouth.
Mm. I think for a little bit about, yes, that's absolutely right. And what that points to is this, that at the moment, almost the same patent laws that we have now were enforced much more stringently 50 years ago than they are
right
now. The fact that they're being enforced so laxly now means that the government really wants to be friends with, is giving the most favorable treatment that it can to the pharmaceutical industry. It sees it as a strategically important industry. So
Yeah. They're
the kinds of things that we all need to bear in mind. And clearly, yeah, the pharmaceutical industry is of tremendous importance to all of us. So you don't want to just generally try and smash the system up. But we do need, generally, if we're all concerned about our health, and industry are probably the greatest drivers of the culture of healthcare these days, we need to sort of think about how to manipulate the system generally so that we're getting a better deal out of it than we are at the moment. A deal that's a little bit more like the way things were in the 1960s, when we were getting a lot more innovative drugs than we're getting now. And generally speaking, you know, people were living much longer than they had been before. That's a point now where life expectancies are beginning to fall in the countries where newest drugs have been used the most, which is not the way things should be.
Right, and it's hard to say that the problem is a lack of drugs. I mean, with problems, like big problems like diabetes and cancer and heart disease, there's a lot of environmental factors that go into that, including diet, exposure to pollution, all of those different things. And no drug is, I mean, drug occurs at the wrong time, right? You don't want the problem to occur and then say, oh, we have a better drug for heart disease or we have a better drug for cancer, if 10 or 20 years before you could have prevented the problem from developing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Well, I think we've pretty much come to the end of our hour, and I would just like to thank you for helping us understand a little bit more about the pharmaceutical industry, and I would like to encourage people to read your book, Pharmageddon, and also I will put a link to your website, risk.org, in the show notes.
Risk.org is the key thing, David. People don't need to read the book unless they want a good sleeping pill, but the key thing is, to get people engaged doing things. And you know, if we can cooperate on things, like trying to pinpoint the adverse effects on drugs, we really can do wonderful things together.
Yes, well, I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think access to information, to me, seems to be one of the biggest challenges of the modern era, and that website certainly helps.
Great.
Anyway, thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Healy, and I'm sure our audience will definitely appreciate what you've shared with us.
Wonderful talking to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.